Scott Spears back with you here midtown Manhattan in the Wellington Hotel. We are having a great time because we are chatting with a gentleman who I like a lot. He's been on the radio program many times. You probably remember him from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, Conan O'Brien, and of course that infamous episode of Seinfeld many, many years ago. He is zoologist Jim Fowler. Jim, hour number two. I enjoyed the first hour so much. I'm glad we can get another 40 minutes in here.
Well, there's a lot of very interesting things going on in the world of wildlife and the natural world. I've tried to extend my knowledge and my interest more in, you know, it's time we talk about saving the natural world and what the arguments are that we can put forward why it's important to human welfare.
And that's what I want to do with this hour, yeah. Jim. The first hour we did the show busy part of
yeah.
it. But I want to talk about the actual nuts and bolts of this. Where are we headed? 2017, where's the natural world headed?
That's a good question, of course. And I wish there were more people were talking about it or being spokesperson people. I've tried to put together an organization called Spokespeople for Wildlife Through Education, because I know a lot of dedicated educators around the country who are lecturing and talking about animals, and it's time for zoological parks and also the people that are lecturing to broaden their message to so it includes human welfare. And if I dare say... it's got to be through communication, and I think communication, frankly, is the challenge of the 21st century.
You were there in the 80s, 70s, when the boom of television was happening. There were other people. Where did we get off the tracks when it came to television and wildlife?
Well, Marlon Perkins had a show in the 50s called Zoo Parade. That was in the days of black and white. And then, of course, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom ran for almost 30 years. And we now have some programs out there. I see people wrestling, not wrestling, but killing alligators in Louisiana. There's a show about that. And as if it's difficult to do. Unfortunately, television has, I think, gone that way a little bit more than I think it should. There are some great shows on PBS. There are shows coming out of Great Britain on wildlife and on animals around the world. And actually, there's some great stories about marine wildlife, you know, the whales and sharks and all like that. I think one of the things that's happened is that our technology has grown to an amazing point where the cameras that are used today, I mean, some of them can almost film in the dark. I remember when I was in the jungles of Africa trying to film black gorillas years ago. On Kodachrome, you know, 16 millimeter, we could hardly do it. But nowadays, the technology is absolutely amazing, and there are some excellent photographers out there. So I'm hoping that we can evolve so that we could still have the interest, you know, for the viewer, but have a stronger message.
You know, I was just thinking, when you were doing that show, you couldn't buy a VCR when you started. You couldn't buy a camcorder that had sound on it for home use.
No.
How did you go out into the wild, have good sound, have a good picture? How'd you do this?
Well, it's very interesting because Marlon had that show called Zoo Parade. And at the end of that, when they thought they better do something else, they decided to take an expedition down to South America. Well, the needless to say, the sound equipment was so heavy, they used to have about two or three people walking through the forest, the jungles, with all this equipment. And it proved not doable because just the cameras and everything else were so heavy. So that's changed, and nowadays there really are some tremendous photographers and out there. But in the early days, when it went from black and white to color, that was a big step. And then it went from 16 millimeter to the digital, and that's another big step.
If you had to put something in the vault that in 100 years somebody was going to open, your work,
all right,
what would it be?
I think I would probably go back onto my realization that we need a bigger picture in our minds. We're sitting on this planet, and Lord knows how we got here and what we're up to. I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I've known a few of the astronauts, and of course our knowledge is growing every day about the universe. I think that the challenge, to answer your question, I think that the challenge of humanity is something that you don't hear much talk about, the mission of humanity. And I've been thinking a lot about that, and I can dare say that there are probably two missions of humanity. One of them is to find out who, what, why, and where we are. This is why that's important. We have a lot of violence going on in the world today, and a lot of it goes back to protecting your beliefs. There are probably eight different religions on this planet right now, and every one of them think they got it nailed, you know. But when you start looking at a bigger picture, you start realizing physically where we are, and that's one of the missions. It's going to take a lot of people to find out who, what, why, and where we are, because you need the support of people in different jobs and different skills, so that a few people at the top of that pyramid can actually go to outer space, which we're doing. The other mission of humanity, in my opinion, is to develop a quality of life for all people on this planet. It's really stupid of us being on a planet soaring around the sun and having everybody fighting over territory and killing each other. It shows the decay of humanity by people doing that. But anyway, what I'm saying is there's another mission I want to talk about real quickly. It's the mission of science. I don't know if you've ever heard anybody talk about these missions, but I haven't. I think the mission of science, frankly, is to discover the basic biological laws of nature that allow life to be on this planet. And we've done a pretty good job of that, but we don't talk about it. They're physical, chemical, and biological laws. And you know what? These laws are not controversial. One of the first laws of nature, of this planet, is that the phytoplankton in the oceans, which is a small organism that's neither plant nor animal, the phytoplankton is the beginning of the entire food chain in the oceans. How many people even think or know about that? The small fish, you know, eat the phytoplankton. And by the way, the sunlight on the oceans affecting the phytoplankton is where a lot of our oxygen comes from. Now, if we knew this, I think we wouldn't dump garbage off New Jersey into the ocean because this system that starts with these phytoplankton in the oceans is critical to our survival. So anyway, to carry that a little bit further, the fish that live on the phytoplankton, they're eaten by a little larger fish. And guess what? The fur seals in the Pribilof Islands, lying up on the beach, there are only so many of them there. And the reason is they live on the fish that the phytoplankton fed for a long time, who now are grown into bigger fish. So really, their population depends on the health of the oceans. And if we made it known that these biological laws of nature are something that are non-controversial, we might take care of the ocean a little bit more effectively. Now, the other basic law of nature has to do with population. There's physical, chemical, and biological laws. The physical laws, a lot of them are the way water is found on the planet and how it runs off and how it creates canyons and all that. But the biological law of nature is very interesting. It's not overpopulation. It's not conservation. It's another term that that is the key to all life, every living thing. And it has something to do with sustainability. Everything on this planet is a consumer from a insect or a small organism to an elephant. They're all consumers. So the key word that we need to start using is sustainable consumption. That's everything that's on this planet right now, including humans, has been here, been sustainable because they're all consumers, but they have to consume on a sustainable basis. That's a law of nature. So getting back to the reality of the missions, the mission that we should have a quality of life, what we call a quality of life, because every culture has a different quality of life, we need to get serious about that and start realizing that if people aren't happy and content, there's going to be violence.
Somebody listening today,
yeah,
what can they do if they want to do something now?
Yeah, well, I would say that it all has to do with communication. There's no reason at all why people listening on this can't become spokespeople for the natural world. I focus on the natural world, but it's really the planet that we need to start talking about. And politically, I think I mentioned that they did a survey where less than 5% of the American public spend more than a half an hour a year thinking about the welfare of open space, wildlife, and wilderness. Now, first of all, if we became aware that we could make a difference by having spokespeople, there's a great need for people of all ages and races to start learning how they can be a spokesperson. That's one way is to carry some of this knowledge out there. But the other it gets a little bit complicated, but not really, because we've pretty well done a lot of the research that it takes to know how to take care of this planet. But we need to see the value of it. Now, what are the arguments that we could use to convince somebody that open space, wildlife, and wilderness is important to our human welfare? That's the key to it. I've worked on some of those arguments, and I will explain very quickly on what some of those are. The first argument for saving anything on this planet has got to be economics. And, it's interesting that eco-tourism, you might be surprised to know that tourism is probably the number one producer of revenue. And ecological tourism or nature-based tourism, people going to our national parks and to our preserves throughout America, is right up there near the top. So that's why economics is usually the first for anything. The second argument for keeping open space, wildlife, and wilderness is called quality of life. Now, quality of life has to be important to everyone, and it's different in different cultures, I admit that. But we've got to start talking about what is quality of life. Is it playing golf and using the internet all day long? Or does it have something to do with learning about the planet and enjoying the natural world? Those are things that have to be talked about. The third argument for saving open space, wildlife, and wilderness is very important. And it may be too much for most people to absorb. But guess what? The violence that we see around this world is often caused by the fact that the earth has been trodden and the natural resources have been exploited to the point where there's no natural resources left. In the Middle East, for example, in Afghanistan, that used to be a green country. It's now, you can hardly find anything that's green there at all because it's been trodden by human beings much more than you'll ever guess. A lot of our coastal areas, in fact, California and Peru, there have been heavy populations of humans along there. And guess what? The fire has killed most of the plants that are susceptible to fire, and the ones left have a lot of oil in them, and that's why they torch so easily. A lot of this has to do with how we treat the earth. But so those, I would say, one of the most important ones is when you know through the media nowadays that you don't have something that somebody else has, it creates violence. You want to get it, and that's the basis of a lot of the fighting and the violence that's going on in certain parts of the world.
What has the internet done, good or bad, for this area of study?
Well, I think it's an incredible opportunity to spread a message. And how to do that, that's a good question. But I think it's going to play a very important role. The internet will, as we learn more and more about what's possible. And it's, you know, it used to be on a show like this, you would reach so many people. But once you get on the internet, it's amazing. If I'm not wrong, you can reach millions of people on the. I know one thing, I've been trying to write a book, and I've been told now that it's very difficult to get a publisher to publish a book because there's so many avenues to take for it. But if you self-publish, there is a group out there that can self-publish. And once you start publishing and get the word out on the internet, you have a much bigger opportunity to make some money and get your word out than you used to. So I think that's what's happening to the internet.
What is the theme of the book that you're writing right now?
Well, I wrote something about Wild Kingdom, the all the stories. It's called Wild Kingdom's Jim Fowler Stories. That way I can use the name.
There you go.
And but I'm also, you know, wanting to, I think there's a possibility of doing a Jim Fowler's Life in the Wild. I've had the opportunity to do some pretty interesting things in my life.
Is there anything you regret career-wise? You wish you would have done differently?
There are a lot of things, yeah. Almost everything comes back to family. And, you know, when it's all said and done. And I hope that my family has had a good boost and a good life. That's number one. But Let's see. There may be a few other things. I think I haven't done well enough in the field of communication. I keep thinking, who am I to go around talking like this? But maybe it has developed because I have seen the world. I've been with Aboriginal people that don't even know we exist. So maybe I do have the right to speak out in this area, but I'm a little bit reluctant about doing that. But that's one of the things I've missed out on. I think I maybe could have done a better job with a family, but who knows about that. My father and mother had a very interesting life. He was a soil scientist, and he developed a plantation down in Georgia. He was able in the 1920s, he was assigned by the government to be a soils expert when they started planting, of all things, pecan trees in Georgia. So he went down and bought 1,000 acres for $2 an acre in 1920. And it's had a lot to do. It's been my lifeblood, this plantation. That's where I was able to run around barefoot with water moccasins, poison snakes all over the place. And I raise animals. I raise eland antelope, which are the largest antelope in Africa, zebras, and things like that, because my mission today is to design these community-oriented, what are called ecological parks. They're not zoos, but they're places where the animals have a really good life, and I take animals that are either orphaned, confiscated, or born in zoos. I don't take them out of the wild. And that way I can reconnect families and children with the world of nature with some of these strong messages I'm telling you about. And that's one of the few ways I think we can keep families connected and learning about the natural world.
What is your reluctancy to go out and talk about this?
I think in order to be effective in talking about it, first of all, you have to know how to use radio and use television, but you also have to know how to reach a lot of people. And I haven't really, if you looked at my cell phone I've got in my pocket right now, you'd see it's a flip phone. It's not one of the fancy new ones. That sort of describes me. I haven't learned enough about the internet yet. That's one of my downfalls.
But it could still be done. Could still be done. Do you think there is anybody, well, let me put it this way, of all the people who've went on television and radio and done things like you've done, who do you think came the closest? Who did the best job beside yourself?
Well, I think there are an awful lot of people. Like I mentioned E.O. Wilson, who's a very well-known ecologist. He's had an audience. And Carl Sagan, he had an audience. But guess what? A lot of the scientists put him down because he dared to get out and speak about these things with the public. He reached the public. And in science, you generally have to get the approval of your peer group before you can say anything. For example, global warming. You don't need to spend 10 years thinking about whether it is or isn't. If there's any possibility, you need to do something. But I think that I have not had the ability to get up in the first the top of the league, which is in Washington. I've often wanted to. I have spoken to large groups like the National. I've gotten awards from National Wildlife Federation and others. But I need to learn a little bit more about how to become a more effective spokesperson.
It's interesting because every election, local, even goes locally, we talk about global warming. And there is, you know, people can do their research, but there are people who still say it is not real.
Right.
Just for people's edification and information today, why is it a real thing? Why is it?
Well, the answer to that is we've known for a long time that it could be. And if we're an intelligent species sitting on a planet, a globe that's moving around the sun, we ought to have the sense and the brains to know that we got to take care of it. So it's not that you don't need to prove something. You need to act on possibilities, in my opinion. Now, if I were, in order for me to be more effective, I would have to learn, you know, the spokespeople for, there are very few spokespeople. I talked about Carl Sagan, but there are very few people out there who dare take a stand from a scientific background in knowing how to talk to the public. And I think that's probably the key to it, is that how do you develop people who are spokespeople?
You know, where we are from in Ohio, we're 45 minutes away from the Columbus Zoo. Their spokesperson, director emeritus, is Jack Hanna. You know something about Jack.
You were.
What is your relationship with Jack Hanna, and what do you feel his place has been in this field?
Well, Jack is he's dedicated, and he does very well in presenting himself to the public. And he's, of course, he started at the Columbus Zoo and had a young person audience very well because he worked with animals and showed animals. But I haven't had a chance to talk to Jack for quite a while, but he did stay at our plantation in Georgia for a while when he was trying to get oriented and know what to do. But he's done a good job of promoting himself and getting a word out. I think that he's been effective. There takes all kinds, you know. Crocodile Hunter, he was for real. Crocodile Hunters told people that I was his hero, even in Australia. Wild Kingdom was shown in Australia. But Crocodile Hunter had the ability to get children and to get them to listen to him. And so I think he was another kind of person who could create an audience. I feel sorry for him because he made a mistake and didn't realize some of the things that a stingray could do. Anyway, but that's there are people like that that are more in the public eye. I'm trying to think of other people that are active and really get out there. I want to say this, that let's face it, it's not that easy, and I'll tell you why. I don't know any election for the President of the United States in the last 20 years that's even mentioned why the natural world is important to humans. The current one, that's not even on the agenda of discussion. That should be number one, in my opinion.
Why should it be number one?
Because, once again, you got to keep your, in your mind, you have to realize that you're on a planet, and how we treat this planet is much more important than just about any other issue, because our health, our welfare, everything depends upon how we treat this planet.
When I look at events, and I'm thinking about a year ago when the horrible event happened in Disney, where the child was dragged off by the crocodile, was it?
Alligator.
Alligator. And the nation was gripped by it. It certainly was followed.
Yeah.
The news channels had the coverage. What did you make of the way the news covered that, and did we learn anything from it?
Well, I learned a lot from it, but I already knew about it because I know alligators. Luckily, I know them quite well, and I've had a few tussles with them myself. But the one thing that they probably didn't think of down there, you know, Disney has another mission other than checking its lakes for alligators. But they knew alligators were in the lake. But what they didn't realize is that when people feed something like that, it makes them start to rely on it and lose the fear of humans. That somebody should have had, whoever was head of their wildlife department down there or the state of Florida should have had the brains to tell them that you're training those alligators to not be afraid of humans. And the gators that I'm familiar with, who there is a season on gators, in some places you can shoot so many of them and then sell the meat and sell the hides. But a gator at a public place like that, you've got to be very careful about it. I know that. I haven't been to Disney World, or I would have probably warned them about that.
Did you think, because I remember at the time, yeah, CNN covered this for 48 hours, almost nonstop.
Yeah.
Was that good?
The end result of it is to kill every alligator in the state of Florida. That's usually the human response.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. The people have to be told about the intertwining roles that animals have in nature. The alligator, by the way, the predator, which an alligator is very important to the laws of nature, because it's the predator that eliminates the weak, the sick, and the stupid. Hmm. And in nature, that's very, very important, because what you're seeing in nature is the end result of the perfection of a species as being the ones that are out there now have been the best of the best. When you see a bird at a bird feeder come in at 40 miles an hour and land on a twig about a quarter of an inch thick from that speed, and then take off in a uniform pattern with four others going around a curve, you know, you have to realize that that's almost impossible to have eyesight well enough to do that. But the ones that couldn't do it, that couldn't escape, have been eliminated from the population due to predators. And so nature has improved itself all along.
When you look back at it, Jim, this long career in broadcasting, which is not over yet, what was the best time? When were you enjoying it the most?
Well, I grew up with a opportunity for adventure. And adventure in many ways is the approaching different subjects, different conditions, different culture. And in a sense, for example, I've been very active in the Explorers Club, and exploration is one of the things that you get smitten with, the field of exploration, finding out new knowledge. That's very, very important. So I was always a explorer and seeking new knowledge and new things. By the way, now that you mention it, I want to throw another one out. I had to speak at the Explorers Club a while back. I've been the honorary chairman of that. Those are the astronauts and the real explorers around the world. And so I came up with something that has happened in the field of exploration. Now, I said originally exploration involved what we call exploitation was the reason. The mission of exploration was exploitation, exploiting the natural resources of the world, finding out where the oil was, finding out where the animals were, what they were, and all that. But guess what it is now? It's gone from, in my opinion, from exploitation to explanation, which is rather interesting. So I gave a talk a while back and to the club and pointed out that it's explanation that now we need to talk about. We've done the exploitation pretty well, but we need to explain to our public and to our fellow human beings what's going on here and why and who, what, why, and where.
And the worst. What was the worst time, Jim? When did you say, boy, I'm just not having the fun I always had?
Well, I've had... I've been very lucky in many areas. I think real quickly, what to answer your question, I've been worried about the fact how to communicate and how to get out there more. And one always has to be aware of some sponsorship and financial rewards about things in our world today.
That's right.
So I've probably failed in that area a little bit.
Is it different now? Do you think, you've been in the business a long time, do you think it's more money driven now than it was then?
I'm afraid it is. I've known people that have, for example, have had a lot of kids. They don't necessarily worry about whether they can take care of them or not. But we humans are going through a very predictable cycle. We're not breeding like we used to. We're not raising large families because we think we can't afford it. That's all based on money, to get to answer your question. And it's probably a reality because it costs a heck of a lot more today than it used to. But we also have to be careful because the essence of life is a family situation. And
in the minutes we have left, we've brought his name up a lot, but what was Marlon Perkins, the person, like?
Okay. Marlon was so well known. He was a household name in the 50s. And Marlon was a very dedicated zoo person. You know, he was the director of a couple of the zoos, Lincoln Park in Chicago, and ended up director of St. Louis. And but Marlon had the ability. He started talking about animals and having trips through the zoo. And I think then he realized the importance of communication. And you could see how Marlon evolved. He came from a farm in Carthage, Missouri. And when Marlon was on that farm, he started taking a tin can, a kerosene can, and he'd put it over his head, and then he'd go dive in the lake and study the fish. So Marlon was number one. He was a good diver. He did very well underwater. He wasn't afraid of it. He also did something that I wish that I had learned more. In all the trips I made around the world with Marlon Perkins, I never heard him complain one time. He was happy with what he did. He trusted the producer. I used to stick my nose in other people's business fairly often because I wanted to, being a scientist, I wanted to make sure everything was done right. But Marlon, I never heard him really complain. So that gives you an insight to him. He was a great family person also.
When you look back at it all, Jim, and I know there's another chapter or a few to be written in your career, but when you look back at it now, when people watch those videos through the miracle of television, whether it's Johnny Carson or Seinfeld or Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, how do you want them to remember you and your contribution?
Well, I'm lucky that apparently I have people now that see those shows and want to go in and be in that profession. And that's a tremendous reward. I mentioned a lot of the wildlife biologists up in Oregon said that they wanted to do that because of watching me. But when it really comes down to it, it's all about family, too. And I think I wish that I'd been able to spend more time with family affairs. I couldn't take the family with me everywhere I went, although I did take my wife and the two kids finally to quite a few different expeditions. But when everything's said and done, it comes down to family.
Jim, I got to tell you, it's been a pleasure to have. This has been very informative and interesting. This is the fastest 2 hours I've had in a while. I thank you so much for coming on, making the trip into Manhattan today while we're here.
Good.
It's a great honor to meet you face to face for the first time.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming on the show.
Well, you gave me a possibility of talking about some of the things that I probably wouldn't ordinarily talked about. So. Thank you.
And we're going to talk in the future. We're going back to the studio in Ohio for about a 15-minute break. Then we'll come back for our last hour today. Remember, Phil Donahue coming up on Thursday, so keep it here. But, Jim, thank you so much.
Thank
Jim
you.
Fowler, one of the true legends.